Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight the Age of Heroes continues through the quest for optimal wellness. And tonight's episode is Herculean Physique Mace Training. We have as our guest author Ben Miller, but first, a song, Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin.
Spirit, sing your song, for with the master.
Greetings and welcome back to Herculean Physique, Mace Training. That was Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin. Tonight, I'm proud to be speaking to author Ben Miller. He wrote a book called Methods of Using the Club for Self-Defense and Exercise in 19th Century Germany. Greetings and welcome, Ben. How are you?
Greetings. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Wow, what a book, what a title, and it's available on Amazon. I have Amazon Prime, so I picked up a free copy of the book.
Nice. I hope you enjoy it.
I looked through it, and it looks amazing. So tell me about your journey. What brought you to writing this book? How did you get there?
Well, it's kind of a long story if you go back to the beginning. Basically, I'll try to condense it. I started in the martial arts about 20 years ago, and started with some Asian stuff, and then I found classical fencing at a place called Martinez Academy of Arms, which ended up being very influential on me, and I still train with them. So Martinez Academy is run by Maestro Ramon Martinez and Maestro Jeanette Acosta Martinez. And their master was a guy named Frederick Rhodes, who was a German. He was born in 1897, and he taught in New York City until his death in 1984. So he had a pretty long life. And he, for anyone who doesn't know what classical and historical fencing is, these were older methods. It really doesn't have bear any relationship to what you see in the Olympics today and see in high school and colleges with what is termed fencing now. That's all been very much modernized. But the old stuff, it was about mind, body, spirit, and it was for the context strictly of self-defense and the duel, not for sport or competition. And they also had a large number of weapons beyond what people think of fencing weapons today. Today people think of foil, FA saber. But back then, in the 1800s and the early 1900s, there were other weapons as well, that older weapons that had the techniques had been preserved fencing masters really cared about the old traditions. So you have things like the rapier, the sword and dagger used together, the dagger used alone. You had all sorts of stick and cane fighting. You had staff weapons. You had all sorts of stuff. What the book is about a system of club that one of these fencing masters taught in the mid 19th century. But getting back to my story, so I stayed with the Martinez Academy. I never looked back. It's like, this is it. I don't need to really go to any other martial arts. I've found where I want to be, and I stuck with them. So that's been since 2005, and then that eventually led to me getting interested in 19th century exercise. And so, first of all, they did actually teach some physical culture exercises there that were very sort of old-fashioned. And so I started looking into the history of that a bit more. And then I got into Indian club swinging. That was like the first thing. And then into wand technique. So wand is like a short staff. Used for very versatile, using a lot of different techniques, and then calisthenics. What the main thing that I was really kind of shocked by was how the mindset was so different than the modern stuff, and that what I had grown up with, when I went, religiously to the gym in college and after college, just doing popular gym stuff and free weights and stuff like that. I found that was really descended from something in the 1800s called muscle culture, where
yes.
It's all about cultivation of musculature in various ways, and which eventually kind of divided into bodybuilding, which is really for pure aesthetics, and then to the strongman stuff, which has sort of like became more of a niche thing, where you're not so much for aesthetics, but for doing like incredible feats of strength and stuff. Actually, my great-great-grandfather, David Miller, was who's a Prussian strongman, and he was known at the time as sort of a local hero, like the strongest guy in San Jose, California, in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And I used to get stories about him from my grandpa all the time when I was a little kid. So it was kind of cool. It kind of all met, you know, sort of blended together. So the physical culture stuff, looking at the 19th century exercises, what was really intriguing about that to me was that it was about mind, body, and spirit. And in terms of the physical, there was all these other things that were important that were sort of getting overlooked in pop gym culture. Like, you know, it was about posture and breathing techniques, things that today most people associate with Asia, with the, you know, Asian martial arts, right, and Tai Chi and yoga and things like that. The West, Europe and America had all that in the 1800s. And in fact, the fact that we did have that has caused a lot of modern scholars to draw a wrong conclusion, so that they actually think that a lot of the stuff that was being done in the 1800s in America and in Europe was descended from Asia, like that basically that the Europeans sort of stole it from China, and that's why they had breathing exercises, and that's why they had these calisthenic positions that look similar to stuff in yoga, which I researched into because I was curious if it was true, and I found out it was complete nonsense. This is basically a guy named Nikola Dali in the 1850s put out this theory, and it was debunked at the time, but then it kind of spread. And how this connects to what we're going to talk about is the reason why they had this mind, body, spirit stuff and the breathing exercises, and they had this specific approach. It came from ancient Greece and Rome, not from Asia. And there was no direct lineage, of course, because, you know, with the fall of Rome, all the amazing exercises and traditions and things, as far as I know, died out. But then in the early 1800s, these physical culture guys, really brilliant guys, started looking at the researching and reading all the old treatises and texts by authors such as Galen and Hippocrates and Plato, and researching the exercises, look at the sculpture and the art, and then they basically decided, hey, we're really missing something. We need to try to resurrect this to some degree, which was it was quite a difficult thing to do because so many of the actual techniques had been lost. They did have a very rich wealth of sort of theory and principles and ideas from the ancients, but a lot of specific techniques had been lost. So they had to sort of come up with new exercises that fit the ancient principles, and they borrowed concepts from fencing and from gymnastics at the time and from dance and stuff like that, and, you know, bringing these body mechanics, but it was all being informed by the principles that they're reading that were in ancient Greece and Rome, and, you know, things like deep breathing, which is a big, if you read like texts in the 1800s on exercise, you will often come across this concept of deep breathing. It's like everywhere at the time. And, that comes directly from the ancient Greek, texts on exercise. So, that's sort of something that, you know, I kept pursuing it and researching it, and it kind of kept growing. And at first it was something that I was just, I was just kind of doing for a hobby, but then, and really for my own benefit, my own personal benefit. But then I started putting out some YouTube videos, and people really were finding value in it. So it sort of snowballed, and I kept with it. And to connect it to this new book, so Methods of Using the Club was, I have all tons of ideas for writing things on club swinging and 19th century exercise. And I have things that are still like in the works that are, you know, probably going to be years before they're done. But this particular one is I found this treatise by a guy named Hugo Rothstein, a German. And he was a fencing master, and he had trained in the Swedish method of exercise, physical culture, which was a big deal at the time in the early 1800s. So he trained in that. He was a German fencing master together, or well, we don't know if actually he invented it or if he had learned it from a teacher, but he was the only one we know that wrote about it and put it down into writing, is this method of fencing with this large two-handed club. And what's intriguing about it is that it's sort of twofold. It's both for self-defense and it's for exercise. So the idea was, you know, his thinking was, you're probably not going to, I mean, people aren't walking around with clubs anymore in the 1850s. They're not going to need to use this as a weapon, but you can get a lot of benefits out of it in terms of the cultivation of your mind, body, and spirit. And also, in the unlikely event that you are attacked or you're in some sort of situation where you need to defend yourself, you would be able to pick up some sort of long, heavy object. And with your knowledge of this method, you could apply it to that object and you'd be able to use it safely and skillfully. So that's sort of the centerpiece of the book. And then I also, mm-hmm. because the other big question in terms of this text was, why would a fencing master choose to write a book or text on a large two-handed club when there were so many other, you know, he could have written about, you know, different types of swords that were being used at the time. And so I started looking into the socio-cultural aspects of the what the club represented to people in the 1800s. And what I found again was that it ties back to ancient Greece and Rome. It really, there is a through line. I mean, through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, you see this fascination with the club, mainly because of Hercules.
Yes.
It's just such a powerful myth that, you know, you have in this, I guess, starting in the early 1800s, you have strong men posing with these clubs. But you even see it turns up in Renaissance fencing treatises, and it pops up in all sorts of interesting places. And you even had female, you had strong women who were also posing with these clubs. And then you also had the exercise methods. They were not used at all for combat, but you have these just purely exercise methods that are using these large, knotted, heavy two-handed clubs, particularly in Germany. And it all seems to tie into this romantic idea that, yes, the club is this, on one hand, we kind of think of it today, you know, and oftentimes when I talk about someone today about this subject and they have no background or knowledge of it to begin with, the first thing that comes to their mind is, you know, cave, the club, that's something that, you know, cavemen would use and that, you know, primitive people would use and stuff like that. And, but actually there, you know, there was a real romantic allure to the club because of Hercules, because of classical mythology. I mean, it's in Renaissance art. It's everywhere at the time. So, and it really influenced and affected the exercise methods and the exercise systems because it was, you know, it was associated with the ultimate, so, you know, Hercules was sort of the ultimate representation of fitness and strength for thousands of years. So he was like this ideal model that they all wanted to emulate. So whether you know, how good was their emulation, of course, who can say? But the fact was that, you know, a lot of people were interested in that. So anyway, I'll throw it back to you if you want to talk about anything specific relating to anything I just said or anything about the book. I'll do my best.
No, it's fascinating, and I'm in my 60s now. I grew up during the time when in Greece the strong men were still going around performing feats of strength, and they were called laiki heroes, which means folk heroes, basically. And some of them gave themselves the name of Hercules, or machiste, in Greek machistes, and that's what they were called, these traveling strongmen. And that's where you get the name machiste that later showed up in the Italian sword and sandal movies. So that was very much part of a living culture during my early years. And of course, it was very formative. And I, too, have researched Hercules through the ages and his symbology, and he's always inspired people to follow his example and to become more fit or more socially responsible. And the fact that he made many errors as a mortal being was, again, it was a cautionary tale that no matter who you are, you can get in trouble and make terrible mistakes. And even though you made mistakes, though, you can still be of service to your community with your talents. In this country's formation, in America's formation, there were several points when the language could have been Greek that we'd be speaking right now, and that Hercules would have played a more prominent role in our American mythology. But he was eventually weaned out of that position because, again, the founding fathers didn't want the country to be represented by violence. And Hercules is, even at his best, a violent figure. So I'm really excited about what you did, and I'm looking forward to reading the book to get more details. Wow, you did a lot of research, and it's great that you're sharing this information, because what little of it I've gleaned came after long hours of research and reading and cross-referencing and looking under different topics just to tie it together. And you've done a lot more of it than I have, so I admire your fortitude and your persistence, because it seems you've given us something great. Now I want to check out your YouTube videos.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad you're enjoying it so far.
And I know you have works in the future. Do you have any other works in print or available besides the book?
Other works besides this one?
Yes, in print.
Yes, they're mostly related to fencing or the history of fencing and dueling. The one that's probably would be the most of interest is the very first one I did in 2015. It's called Self-Defense for Gentlemen and Ladies. And that's by, well, basically it's a treatise, another treatise that I sort of discovered that was written by a Danish-American martial arts master named Colonel Monstery. And the extraordinary thing about him was he was just an amazing guy. He had survived participation in more than 50 duels. A sword, knife, and pistol, and he had fought under 12 flags as sort of a soldier of fortune. He was like traveling all over Europe and America and South America, and then he opened a number of martial arts schools in the United States. This is in the 1850s, basically through the end of the century. I think he died around 1901. So he was just an amazing character, and he wrote this book on self-defense. It's got punching, kicking, grappling. It's got quarter staff. It's got self-defense with a cane or stick. So it's just a really interesting martial arts book, and it's sort of fallen into complete obscurity after its initial run in the 1870s. He sort of connects to this because he was actually he trained, even though he was a Dane, he trained in the Swedish system of physical culture that had been created by this guy, Ling, Per Henrik Dahlholm. And that person is also mentioned in the new book, Methods of Using the Club. In fact, you'll find his picture around page 46. And Ling is super important because this was the guy who really created the most influential method of exercise that would go on to sort of influence everything else that came in the 19th century and the 20th century. And he also happened to be a fencing master. And he was the one who did all this research into the writings of ancient Greece and Rome to create a method that was based on those principles. So really, really interesting and influential character. Monstery, who wrote the Self-Defense for Gentlemen and Ladies, was his, not his direct student, I think it's his student of one of his students. In terms of the other books, there's another one I wrote about that was a
a collaborative effort called Scottish Fencing, and another one called Irish Swordsmanship, Fencing and Dueling in 18th Century Ireland. So those are like the main ones, but they're about, yeah, basically if you're into sword history and martial arts history in America and Europe, those might be of interest.
That sounds wonderful. We have to schedule another show to get into your other books on the knife fighting and sword fighting. And that is amazing. Do you also teach people these methods? Because you mentioned that you were a practitioner of the martial arts, and that's what led you down this avenue. Do you also have a school where you teach people the actual techniques?
I don't have a school. I've been a student for a long time of fencing, and we have a small group out here. And then in terms of the physical culture, I first taught at an event called Combat Con in Las Vegas, and so that fairly recently. That was when I first taught the use of the German wand, and I've taught some other people that privately out here live in Los Angeles right now. So there's a couple people really because of that classic Combat Con who wanted to learn it. I've been reconstructing some other stuff too, but it's just not ready to. Like the Swedish method and a few things. It's not quite ready to be taught yet. But so mainly in terms of teaching right now, it's just the wand or the staff for exercise, which comes from the Turner. The methods that I base it on come from the Turner physical culture movement from Germany.
Yeah, a lot came out of the ancient era. Like you had Milo of Croton that pretty much invented or is credited with inventing progressive resistance. He's the one who picked up a calf every day until it grew into a bull, and he continued to lift it up every day. So he got progressively stronger as the calf grew larger. They had a form of weights in antiquity that I've seen in a couple of exercise stores, and I bought a few of them. They used to use them not so much for bodybuilding purposes, but for jumping. They used to swing the weights, and they'd be able to jump further with the momentum. So a lot of those techniques are finding their way back into Dick's Sporting Goods and Modell's. I don't know if Modell's is still around, but those type of stores are starting to have that type of equipment in them.
Interesting. I'll have to look out for that.
So the things that you're currently teaching with the staffs, how long would it take for someone to attain some sort of mastery with that? I know that's kind of like a fuzzy question because it depends on the individual and how much time they devote to practicing and so forth. But, generally, the people that you've taught, how long did it take for them to gain a proficiency with it or a basic proficiency with it?
I would say in answer to the first question, to the mastery, I couldn't answer that question because I can't claim to be a master of that myself. I mean, I've been researching it and practicing it for years, I've gathered all these extremely obscure sources, and I'm still working on the advanced stuff myself. I'm practicing that, and people who have started learning from me, I mean, that's all been, that's only started in the last year. So, they're still really beginning with it. You know, they're doing good, but you know, it's still, I wouldn't call any of it advanced work yet.
Okay.
I don't have a solid answer to that question, but what I can tell you is that based on the level of complexity and sophistication that I'm seeing in the research that I'm doing from, you know, unfortunately there's no, well, there is a living tradition of this, but it's, you know, there's an old guy and I've talked to you, but it's what survived is a living tradition. Well, let me put it this way. There's no living master of the wand technique or, you know, as far as I'm aware, maybe there is somewhere that I don't know about. That could be the case. But of what I'm aware, I'm not aware of any, anyone alive who is like really a master of it. So, there are people with like scraps of, who have learned some of the exercises and learned some of the movements and the techniques. So, that's informing what I'm doing, and then I'm looking at the literature from the period. Some of it was really hard to find and really obscure, but it there's a lot of sophistication to it. So as I said, it's something I'm still working through. You know, in order to, I think I can say that, you know, it would definitely take anyone years to get become highly skilled. With that, it's going to take years. Exactly how many years, I couldn't really say at this point, and it's going to depend also on, you know, the aptitude of the particular person. Some people have different, you know, one thing with the wand is that, because it requires a lot of agility and flexibility, that a person who is, you know, extremely strong, you know, bench, you know, 300, 400 pounds. I mean, that person might have a lot of trouble because, you know, there's all sorts of postural aspects to this. And like I said, you know, developing nimbleness and agility and things like that. So some people like, you know, I've already seen this with in the group class that I did, you know, the aptitude is so, vary so much in the physical issues. It's just not a matter of like how much weight can I bench, and if I do it every day at a certain time, you know, like the thing with the calf that you mentioned, it's a little more complicated than that because there are more aspects to your physicality that it sort of requires and is sort of cultivating. So, you know, in theory, yeah, it's complicated.
Well, thank you for answering the question. And it led my mind down various avenues of inquiry. So I'm going to start researching certain things now. I'm certainly going to research the emulation of Hercules in those decades that I might have missed that you talked about.
Oh yeah.
So where do you see your research taking you? Because your research is reviving a lost era and bringing it to light. And I skimmed through your book. I ordered it minutes before we started the show, and I had just a quick glance at it. It looks amazing. It looks fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to reading it. Aside from the books you talked about and the things that you have in the works, where do you see your quest taking you? Is it too soon to tell, or do you have a goal in mind?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually something I've been thinking a lot about because I feel that there's far more value to this stuff, to 19th century physical culture, than I initially realized when I got into it. I didn't comprehend. I just thought when I was getting into it that that these would be some sort of you know, really interesting. I was interested because it was older and to, you know, to a big extent. You know, it's just like, wow, I'm interested in old things in general and ancient things, and I thought, oh, wow, this is really cool. And I thought I could sort of see right from the beginning that this was something that was maybe a little more complementary to martial arts training than modern exercise, because I'd done more of like popular bodybuilding type of stuff when I was in my 20s. And I often found that that interfered with my fencing and my martial arts, sort of like it kind of can slow you down when you need speed and agility and or nimbleness. It could sort of like get in the way. But I found that, with a lot of the mobile apparatus and techniques that you use in the 19th century stuff, like with the Indian club and things like that, that was more that was like a better fit with the martial arts that I was doing. So that's sort of like why I got into it. But then the more I read, and I've come to realize that this was something that would benefit so many people, and especially I feel like modern sports and the modern gym approach, I think, is really geared towards people in their 20s and 30s, but it sort of fails. I think it sort of fails a lot of other people, especially, once you get into middle age and people get older. I mean, there are exceptions where you hear about, like, in the news, the person who's 90 years old and they're still doing the bench press or they're still doing the free weights. I mean, those people absolutely exist. But generally speaking, the modern approach is very difficult to the modern, strength building approach, I think, is very difficult for a lot of people to maintain into old age. And then you have, like, on the flip side of that, you have the stuff that is for, like, the exercise that you see for old people today that they teach in nursing homes and classes. I mean, it's like, it's kind of, it's just this so simple, gentle, absurd stuff. And I'm not sure how much that's helping people either, except for maintaining a little bit of mobility and some basic stuff. But you look at, like, in the 1800s, in the early 1900s, you can find these pictures, and you can even find silent film footage of these old guys with white hair, and they're doing, like, flips, and they're doing, like, parallel bars, and they're doing this incredible stuff, and they don't have, like, widow's humps. These guys are, like, you see these, like, 90-year-old amazing athletes. And so the cool thing about the 19th century stuff is that it was really designed to benefit everybody and with this idea of longevity in mind. So they weren't too focused, except for some of the strongman stuff. They didn't tend to be as focused on things that you were just going to have to give up once you hit, 50 or whatever. And also just the sophistication of it. I mean, it really, the sophistication of these 19th century methods that were created by doctors and really brilliant people. You look at, some of the people who are doing this stuff today, you look at the modern gym coaches, and certainly gym coaches I had, God bless them, no offense to them, but they pale in comparison. The problem that poses for me, or the challenge that it poses for me, is that it's a lot. Like, it's a big task. It's a big challenge because it's so sophisticated. It's not something you can really just figure out in a year or two. People train and study this stuff for. They would study with a master, or a gymnastic director, or whatever, for many, many years, and to develop this stuff, and that they had a teacher to guide them. But in my case, a lot of the stuff I'm trying to reconstruct, revive. In some cases there are teachers, like with the Indian clubs. There are old masters of Indian clubs who are still with us, and unfortunately. Who knows how long they're going to be with us. And there's, who knows how many people are learning from them. Some of the other stuff though, like, those Swedish calisthenics and the wand stuff. And there's a lot of other stuff where, the knowledge has just been lost. And, it's quite a monumental task to sort of, it's like, a pediatrician, trying to figure out neurosurgery from a book, that is not something easily done,
No.
Without a teacher. So, you know, fortunately, I still have some amazing teachers, like fencing masters, and some mentors in the Indian club stuff who've been, you know, that is heavily informing. That's sort of been like the rudder guiding my ship is the stuff, even though maybe the specific techniques, maybe they didn't know some of these specific techniques for the 19th century exercises, but the principles and the approach and things like that have been heavily influential. So it's a long road. Ultimately, I would hope that it'd be something that could benefit, you know, all of humanity, as lofty as that sounds. I'm not quite sure yet how that's going to happen. It's something I'm still trying to figure out. Luckily I have some, I met some great people, who feel similarly about this. And who are sort of fighting this good fight. People like my friend, Ron Jones, who's into classical physical education, and who's trying to really trying to propagate that, and who's a professional. So we'll see what happens. But it's a big task. And all I'm really trying to do right now is I'm trying to learn as much as possible, and then at the same time, the things that I feel strongly enough about that I've learned it and I've practiced and I've researched it enough and I've honed it enough that I feel like it's ready to show to other people, then I'll go ahead and teach that to other people. But it's a long road, and I wish I could give you a more concrete forecast, but I'm not sure at this point yet.
That's perfectly great because we don't often know where we're going to wind up when we begin our journeys, and until enough things start connecting in a way becomes clear, we're kind of just like doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and seeing what catches on or what demonstrates movement to get a different perspective. So you answered very honestly, and I thank you for that. Now, I'm in my 60s, as I said before. I'll be 64 in a month or two. I don't see myself doing flips like the white-haired gentleman that you described, but I would like to be more mobile. I currently lift weights, not as heavily, nowhere near as heavily as I did when I was younger. I tried different things. I got into club or mace work a few months ago. I don't consider myself apt at it at all. I'm still playing with it as far as I'm concerned. But I've been able to increase the weight that I'm dealing with and be more graceful in my movements. First time I tried, I did it with a 5-pound mace, and I hit myself on the head. Then I injured my shoulder during the same workout. So that was a few months ago.
Oh, boy.
So I've gotten better since then. I could only do the shoulders with the mace or the Indian club twice a week. If I do it more than twice a week, my injuries start acting up. So I'm continuously, again, playing with my movement and trying to do that better. So with some of the other hosts who are on in years, some of them older than I am, we decided to wrestle with old age, as Hercules did in the myths. And we're trying different things, everything from, you know, different vitamins to different dietary techniques to different types of exercises. So what would you recommend, since you brought up working with older people and having older people not become sedentary and immobile and unable to move around?
Gosh, well, that's an important question. You know, I can only speak to what I've already, I can't give you a completely or authoritative answer on that. What I can say is from what I've seen, it's also the caveat that, you know, any of these methods, and they say this at the time, the people who are writing about them say that any exercise that's done incorrectly can suddenly become destructive.
Yes.
So the Swedes, especially the Swedish calisthenic, they'll especially harp on that. They'll say, you know, listen, yeah, we've created this system that we believe is perfect, but you know, if you do it a little bit wrong, then it's suddenly going to mess you up. So, you know, that's the thing. But I would say, if done correctly, you know, light club swinging is great for mobility. And they used to use it in World War I, and I believe in the late 1800s, light club swinging was used to rehabilitate injured soldiers who would have, like, you know, got shot in the shoulders or the bicep or whatever, lost feeling in their fingers and stuff like that. They would start swinging with clubs, and they would get that back. So, and that's another thing is that which is interesting about the 19th century physical culture is, especially the Swedish method, which was like the first one that influenced everything else, is that they were teaching both exercise for healthy people and they were teaching rehab exercises. So they had they called it the exercise for people that were already healthy. They called educational gymnastics, and then exercises for the sick, they called medical gymnastics. What's interesting to me is that so the people who graduated from that school, they knew both, right? So they're not going to teach you a calisthenic exercise that's eventually going to that's going to put wear and tear on your joints, and it's eventually going to lead to some sort of problem decades down the line, which is something that you see a lot today. I have plenty of multiple relatives who are getting hip replacements and knee replacements and stuff like that. Who are athletics. I mean, my uncle ran, I think, over 40 marathons. He's got a hip replacement now. But the cool thing about this 19th century stuff is, the Swedes, they already knew what would mess you up, right? Because they were teaching both physical therapy and exercise for the healthy. So they were still thinking about the physical therapy aspect of it when they were prescribing exercises for healthy, athletic people. So, and I think the big reason why you can see this silent film footage of these guys who made it that far and were still in really great shape and could do all this great stuff because those methods were designed so that it wasn't going to put any wear and tear on your system. So getting back to your original question, I'd say light club swinging. I would certainly say the Swedish calisthenics, but that's not going to be helpful because there's almost nobody doing it. And I'm in the process of trying to reconstruct that, but that's a challenging one. And then the wand stuff is great. And actually there's a lot of wand stuff that's available. Like if you look at the channel of Ron Jones, who I mentioned before, he's got some videos on there for basic stuff that, you could start off doing that could be helpful. Let's see. I mean, that's the main stuff, really. I guess I would suggest. I honestly would suggest if you you're in New York State.
I'm in New Jersey.
Oh, you're in New Jersey. Okay. This isn't going to be helpful for people outside of the tri-state area, really, but. But my fencing masters, they run a school called the Martinez Academy of Arms, and it's Maestro Ramon Martinez and Maestro Jeanette Acosta Martinez. They teach these classical and historical fencing methods, which are traditional. It's been passed down from master to student, and that's stuff that you can do into old age, and it'll keep – I mean, their fencing master was – 87. He died. He was teaching a month or two before he died, and fencing. So that was the cool thing about classical fencing is that it was considered a branch of 19th century physical culture. So mm-hmm. it is the same people were you know, they had their sort of hands in both worlds, the physical exercise world and the fencing world. So they were sort of both guided by this idea that, you know, there's real focus on the joints being perfectly aligned, the skeletal alignment. So it's all stuff that is not going to put any wear and tear on your body, and you'll be able to do it into old age. And that's not the case in modern popular Olympic fencing. Now it's like all modern fencers I know who are serious modern fencers, and yeah, by the time they're in the 40s and 50s, a lot of these, they have to stop. A lot of them walk with limps. It's because that's just designed to, it's the sports designed to win at these games, and so they don't really put the focus is on, you know, vigor and achievement and doing it safely. That's not going to put wear and tear in your system. That's secondary. So if you could do classical fencing, then I would recommend that, and that you can go to an actual living master of that stuff. And there's also, if anyone's in Florida or on the West Coast, you could look up classical fencing. There are some schools for people who've been trained and certified by my maestros, by Maestro Martinez. So people in those areas might also be able to take advantage of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is awesome. And if you, in the promos that I put up for tonight's show, if you could put some of the links there, they'll distribute among people who receive the promo.
Oh,
this way they can explore these things for themselves. And I'd like to have you, we only have like 7 more minutes for today's conversation, but I'd like to have you on a few of the other shows. One of them would be Myths of the Mace, where we talk about the mythology of, maces and wands and staffs and things like that. I've had all sorts of people on for that one, including wizards and witches and mythophiles. So these items have significance, you know, in many different fields of study and human endeavor. So if you can share some of the myths as you did today, like the emulating of Hercules through the club, that would be great. Then we have other like fitness shows where I can invite you on. You can talk about all your blade books and your blade experience. And thank you for introducing that into tonight's show, because it's fascinating.
I'm definitely open to that. Thanks for the invitation.
And I can definitely see you, you're not there yet, but I can definitely see you once it clicks for you, starting a movement. I've seen many, like the Mace movement. That kind of flowered, and now it's an industry with its own events and things like that. So I can definitely see what you're doing catching on and becoming a movement at some point in your journey.
Yeah, you know, I can too. And the trick with that is it's got to be done right, because I've seen, you know, it happen where, and it's not just in the modern era, but it's like hundreds of years, you see that. When something sort of becomes popularized too quickly, and
uh-huh.
without preserving the quality instruction, that it can sort of like go off the rails and become not as good, and then everyone looks at it and says, oh, well, that's not as good, and it's a reflection on the original thing, and then the original thing sort of like falls out of popularity. So, I'm aware that it could become successful if anything, just because the material is just so valuable. I mean, it's just, that's what I found myself, that's what I found on my own. And it's so beneficial, but like, yeah, I'm sort of still wrestling with, how that could happen in a healthy way, because there is, with any sort of popularization, there's also a danger. So that
right.
Go off the rails. So I'm still, yeah, something I'm still very, very much thinking about.
Well, I believe in your journey, and I respect your caution that what you said is correct. And I'm looking forward to checking in on your journey every now and then to see how it's going. How can people enter your world? How can they find out more about these topics and your writing and your videos, what's the best way to reach you?
Well, my videos are, we have a YouTube channel called Physical Culture Historians and a Patreon of the same name. And then I'm just, you know, you could find me on Facebook. My name is Ben Miller. And then in case too many Ben Millers pop up, you could also contact me through the page, the official Facebook page for my first book, Self-Defense for Gentlemen and Ladies. You could send a message to me through that, and then, you know, I'll get that message eventually. Yeah.
I put up links to your page, the Self-Defense for Gentlemen and Ladies. An awesome page, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
We have a couple more minutes. Any last thoughts you'd like to leave people with as they venture forth into physical culture exercises?
I would say, you know, the thing that I often encounter in you know, people who are interested in this stuff or new to it is like, well, what do they want out of it? And you know, if you're, you know, a lot of the modern people who are steeped in the modern stuff, they're into exercising because either they want to, they ask, what are the gains? You know, what, how much weight can I lift? Or if it's more like the bodybuilding mentality of I want to look good. So, you know, I think that the 19th century stuff can accomplish that, but it's really not the main reason to do it. And you could probably just, it would just be much easier for you to do the modern stuff, right? If that's what you're looking to do. But if people are interested in it because they want to cultivate like a holistic all around health and something that is going to endure and is going to be with them, is going to be conducive to longevity and is going to be with them, they'll be able to do it till they're older. Then the 19th century stuff, I think, the old time physical culture is really beneficial. That's pretty much it. And I don't know if there's any last questions or anything else you had to ask me, or any facets of what
very,
I talked about.
I'm very impressed by your work. I like the way you're doing it, you know, very slow and methodically, and you're not claiming miracle powers or things like that. You've been very honest in your answers. So again, that impressed me. It speaks a lot to your character. And I'm looking forward to speaking with you again. And thank you. Everything was very last minute. I think I've corrected all the typos I made in posting everything. And I'm looking forward to having you back on again.
Great. That would be great. Thanks a lot for having me.
And thank you for being here and sharing your expertise and your journey. And thanks to all who tuned in, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you and you're waiting in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, and thanks again, Ben.
Thank you.